Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Very pleased to have John Cohen return to UCSD to talk on about his recent fascinating book, Almost Chimpanzee. I say return to UCSD because 30 years ago he got his bachelor's degree in science writing from UCSD. In the intervening years, he's had a distinguished career in writing and other media. He's currently a correspondent for the Science magazine, a very prestigious magazine in the area of science. He's also written for the New York Times magazine, Smithsonian, Atlantic Monthly, New Yorker, and other publications. In addition, he's worked on many documentaries for Science and Slate, and PBS created a documentary on AIDS based on one of his other books, Shots in the Dark. So we're very, very pleased to have him come to the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute. Please welcome him.
Thank you very much, Jack. It's a kind introduction, and thanks to all of you and to the Osher Institute. I'm also a lifelong learner. That's my real job. I'm a professional student, and I get paid to write papers. I hope my papers are more interesting than the papers I wrote as an undergraduate, but that's for others to determine. And thanks to UCSD TV for covering this. This is my book, Almost Chimpanzee, that came out in the fall, and that's the back of a chimpanzee there. And the subtitle is Searching for What Makes Us Human in Rainforest Labs, Sanctuaries, and Zoos. And I spent several years traveling around meeting with people who study chimpanzees, both in the wild and in captivity, to understand what that research was telling us. And I was surprised by many things that I found, and I hope to surprise you with some of those things. My talk includes some videos, and I will take questions at the end rather than stopping along the way. This is a wild chimpanzee in Uganda, in the Kibali Forest. Which one? I know it's hard to tell. This is a funny, there's a little background to this photograph because we had been following this chimpanzee all day with a researcher who was tracking his movements with a GPS to see what this male did during his day. And my photographer, I've worked with him for many years, wanted the chimpanzee's face in the photo with my face. And the chimpanzee wouldn't look at the camera. So he went, psst, and that I was laughing because you're not allowed to do that. You're supposed to not interfere with them in any way, shape, or form. But his little psst made the chimp look, and then he took that picture. So, first of all, I just want to start at the way out in space and look down. There are five great apes. There are chimpanzees, bonobos, which are a very close relative of chimpanzees, and are as closely related to humans as chimpanzees, but they are not chimpanzees. There are gorillas, and there are orangutans, and of course, there are humans, and that's Jane Goodall, who, more than any other scientist, made chimpanzee research famous. Apes are not monkeys. This is a common mistake that people make. They call a picture of a chimp a monkey. Curious George, the book that many children grew up on since 1947, refers to George as a monkey. George is a chimpanzee. Chimpanzees and all other great apes do not have tails. Monkeys have tails. There's only one monkey that doesn't have a tail, and it's misnamed a Barbary ape. So when you hear somebody refer to a chimpanzee as a monkey, please correct them. And chimpanzee researchers go nuts about this. Monkeys, in an evolutionary sense, evolved from a common ancestor with humans 25 million years ago. Humans and chimps split off 5 or 6 million years ago, maybe 7. There's a huge difference. And there's a huge difference in behavior, in body structure, and in abilities all around. They're not the same. So where do the great apes live? The map on the left is just a map of the world to orient you. The map on the right shows where chimpanzees live in Africa, the yellow and red. And you can see across Central Africa, there's a band of chimpanzees all the way from West to East Africa. And orangutans and gorillas live in that same range, and bonobos only live in the Democratic Republic of Congo, south of the Congo River. The orangutans live on the far right in Indonesia and Sumatra and Borneo. And there are two species of orangutans, the Bornean and the Sumatrans, and because they're on islands, they never mix with each other. Chimpanzees also live in captivity. They live, as we all know, at zoos, although the San Diego Zoo and Wild Animal Park, they have no chimpanzees. There are bonobos. One of the largest bonobo colonies in the world is here in San Diego, but there are no chimpanzees here. And they also live in research facilities, and there are about 1,000 chimpanzees in the United States that live in research facilities. So we are very, very similar in many ways, and I don't want to discount this in my talk because I'm going to focus on differences, but I want to stress that the similarities are real. They look like us. They have an intelligence that is closer to ours than possibly any other species. They have emotions that are very similar to ours. And they have a social lifestyle that mirrors ours in many ways, and they have culture that they pass on from generation to generation. By culture, what researchers mean is if you look at one group of chimpanzees in one part of even the same country and another group in the same country, they might fish for termites with different methodology. And that's passed on from generation to generation. That's what culture means in terms of chimpanzee. It's largely how they forage for food. But the difference is defined.
A new state-of-the-art chimpanzee exhibit has brought hundreds of people to the Detroit Zoo.
Look at Nikki, look at the monkey. Wave to him, say hi.
Look at the monkey.
They have no idea a real life and death drama is about to unfold. Rick Swope, a husband and father of three, has jumped into a murky, water-filled moat to save a drowning chimp named Jojo.
He needs some help! Somebody help him!
I couldn't believe anybody would do that.
Jojo fell in while being chased by another, more aggressive ape. Zookeepers are on the scene, but they realize just how dangerous it is for a human to jump into an enclosure with apes. Despite their warning, Rick jumps in anyway.
There's a man. Hurry up, this man can't do it by himself!
Dr. Linda Brent runs Chimp Haven, a sanctuary for chimpanzees. She says chimps are extremely dangerous, very territorial animals.
Now, Jane Goodall uses this story of that rescue to say, do you see how similar we are? So much so that this man saw a drowning chimp, risked his life, and hopped the fence. He was just a zoo-goer and rescued the chimp. I spoke with him at some length. That's not really what happened. He didn't jump in there to save the chimpanzee because it was so similar to a human. He grew up on a farm, and he was used to rescuing animals that fell into water, whether it was a cow or anything else. And I think what's most remarkable about it is exactly the opposite thing. Chimpanzees cannot swim. They cannot be taught to swim. The reason that chimpanzee was saved, again, is because of our differences. No chimp would jump into water and rescue a human. Wouldn't happen. But humans do that. That's not to say chimps won't help humans. They will. And they will, and a gorilla once had a kid fall into a zoo enclosure and took care of it until it could give it back. But this is a very critical distinction between us. What does it mean that they can't swim? Chimpanzees are bounded by rivers. They don't travel very far. They can't. They cannot cross rivers. That means they don't face many different pathogens. They don't meet many different species. Their immune system doesn't evolve in the way that ours does. And it severely limits what it means to be a chimpanzee, because you're trapped by rivers. Unless you get on a log and float across, or a human builds a bridge, or you somehow transport across that river. But for the most part, they don't move around. Their area that they can move around is very constrained. That was a startling difference to me. So the first big difference, though, is that we walk upright, as everyone knows, and they knuckle drag. They can walk upright. They just don't do it for long distances. We have bigger brains. Our brains is about 3 times larger. Now, you can say their body is smaller, so their brain should be smaller. But even when you make that adjustment, our brains are much larger. The top is a human brain, and the bottom is a chimpanzee brain. And the photographs show real human and chimpanzee brains being studied by researchers. We talk with words and sentences, and they pant, hoot, and scream. I'll play a little audio for you.
A comparison of the vocalizations of bonobos, pan paniscus, with those of chimpanzees, pan troglodytes. We start with hoot concerts by a group of individuals, first bonobos, then chimpanzees.
So even bonobos and chimpanzees have very different
vocalizations. Now, hooting by a single individual.
Vocalizations.
The first example is by a bonobo and is immediately followed by a slowed-down version of the same hoot. The second example is hooting by a chimpanzee.
They also grunt and bark. You hear the grunting.
Finally,
and barking.
Scream vocalizations, first by a bonobo and second by a chimpanzee.
Very high, piercing sound from bonobo. Almost sounds like a bird. And this almost sounds like a human in trouble. So many of the differences are tricky to see. They can walk upright, but they use a lot more energy than humans, and this test on a treadmill showed that by measuring its oxygen uptake. And only humans can run long distances. We're the only species that can do endurance running. And that may have something to do with how we evolved, because we did that to chase down prey, most likely. Chimps are extremely smart. This is in Japan. This chimp has been taught to recognize numerical ordering of numbers. It gets a treat every time it gets it right. This is not a trick. This chimpanzee truly understands at least how to get the treat by touching numbers in the sequence. People have argued, does it truly understand the meaning of a number? And the answer may be no, in the sense of a 3-year-old child understands that three is one more than two. When you teach a chimpanzee a new number, it takes just as long to learn that next number as it did the previous one. Whereas a child doesn't have that problem because they know that, hey, 5 is 1 more than 4. 6 is 1 more than 5. The chimp doesn't necessarily understand that concept. But this research group, is probing what are the limitations. Now, this next experiment with the same chimpanzee masks the numbers the milliseconds after the chimp touches the first button, and it can remember, short-term memory, the ordering. Try and do it yourself. Made a mistake. Doesn't get it all right, but When you test that chimp against graduate students, the chimp does much better. Why did they evolve short-term memory or retain a short-term memory that we perhaps lost? Who knows? But they might have better short-term memory. And I think it's instructive because we often think of ourselves in this evolutionary sense as at the top of the ladder. Well, come on. No one in this room can climb a tree as well as a chimpanzee. And I'm not telling you that because of your age. No human can. They do many things better than we do, or with more of whatever it is than we do. And it may even go into the cognitive realm. But they don't teach. This is a nutcracking mother with the child watching. But the mother never does what a teacher does. The mother, they've videotaped these chimps for 20 years, nutcracking like this. They've never seen a single instance of teaching. Well, what's teaching mean? Well, this is more sushi master. You watch the master and you learn. But the mother never does reward and punishment with the child. The mother, it's never coming at any cost to the mother to teach. A teacher has to, it comes at some cost. The mother's just allowing the child to observe. And if the child gets it right, the mother doesn't seem to care. If the child gets it wrong, the mother doesn't seem to care. They do imitate, though, and we say that, you know, chimps ape things for a reason, because they're very good at aping. So the researcher shows the chimp to get that sound. You stick the stick in the top there. It's a juvenile chimp. You know, maybe a year old. How'd that happen? So, that's a sign of intelligence as well. I don't think you'd see a dog witness that once and then stick its head down, look, pick up the stick and do it. They can learn to say words, cup, with great effort. This was a family that raised this chimp in a home and taught Vicky to say cup by putting her hand over her mouth. And also they taught Vicky to say papa. Listen very closely.
Papa.
It's kind of ridiculous. That's the best they could do, working with that chimp for years. They can't vocalize the way we vocalize because of their vocal cords, but they also don't have a natural ability to mimic sounds like that in the way that we do. The average human child that goes through high school in our system learns about 60,000 words by the time they graduate high school. Chimpanzees can learn words, and they hit the wall at about 200. They can also recognize objects. This is an orangutan. The researcher shows the orangutan cup. The orangutan touches cup. Clearly, AZ, the orangutan here, knows the meaning of objects. And I watched AZ do this with many, many different objects. There's no question in my mind or anyone else's that apes can recognize symbols. This is a lexigram board that has over 250 different symbols. And this is a bonobo. And I'm speaking to the bonobo.
Hey.
Hi, Kamanish. I'm John. Can you find egg? Egg? Kamanish wasn't that interested at first.
Could you please find egg?
Hi, Kamanish. Would you please find egg?
Egg.
Very good.
Out of over 250.
Could you please find banana? Banana? Please find banana?
Banana.
Oh, that's good. How about ball? Find ball?
Ball.
Very good. Could you ball? In this case, there are two different symbols for ball. And she went to both of them. I've had enough of this crap. But that was fairly remarkable. Now, the researchers, this is in Iowa at the Great Ape Trust, will tell you that the orangutan, I mean the bonobos there, they have orangutans too, that orangutan before was from there, have a massive amount of comprehension, much more so than the limitations of this lexigram board, that they maybe understand thousands of words. A lot of scientists are hugely skeptical about that, and that research group has not published research that has convinced people that they truly do understand thousands of words. And as we all know, dogs can learn words. This is a dog, Rico, that can identify 200 different objects. They're speaking in German, so unless you speak German, you won't understand it. But Rico repeatedly would pick out the right object, and if you put a new object there with a new word, Rico would know by exclusion to pick that object, because Rico didn't know the word and knew it had to be that thing. So I think we have to be very critical when we think about what's the difference between chimpanzee communication and human communication. They communicate on very sophisticated levels through pant hooting and grunts and screaming, but they don't have language. They don't string words together into sentences and paragraphs. They don't do what we call recursion, where we embed ideas. The man was wearing a yellow hat. He's the guy over there sitting with the cigar in his pocket. I don't really like his wife. And anyway, now, you all followed me. There's no ape that communicates like that. They don't embed ideas into each other. And they hit the limits of dogs, 200 words or so. So their capacity for vocabulary doesn't seem to be anywhere near our capacity for vocabulary. And their ability to speak with grammar and syntax doesn't seem to be anything like ours. They don't control fire or cook. This is a chimp on the right that I followed. He's the one in the first picture that I showed you, that I followed all day from sunup till sundown. And all day long, he ate, he defecated, he ate, he defecated, he napped, he ate, he defecated, he ate, he defecated, he napped, he ate. Chimps chew for more than 6 hours a day. We, our children, who are between 9 and 12 years old, chew for about an hour a day because we cook our food. And cooked food allows us to get nutrients out of the food very quickly. They don't have that option. And they don't eat very much meat. Only about 1 to 2% of their diet is meat. And raw monkey, which is one of their favorite food sources, just isn't that nutritious. You get much more nutrition out of the same thing by cooking it. And there was an experiment done with rats in a laboratory where they took pellets of food and they pumped them full of air, or they left them the way they were. They're exactly the same pellets. When it's pumped full of air, the rats become obese because it's easier to digest and they get more nutrients out of the exact same food. That's what cooking does. It allows us to get more nutrients, more calories, out of the exact same food. And there's a book by a Harvard professor, Richard Wrangham, that looks at how this possibly was a key force in human evolution. Our masticatory muscles are extremely different. On the left is a macaque monkey, in the middle is a gorilla, and on the right is a human. And you can see that both the monkey and the gorilla have what's called a sagittal crest up here, where a huge muscle attaches to the top of their head because they're chewing so much and their jaws need to crush so much. Ours are much smaller, and there's an argument, and this was published in Nature magazine, that that also led to the increase in the human skull size, so it could handle a bigger brain. That might have been a force that led our brain to grow larger because our masticatory muscles didn't have to be as large. So anatomy is destiny. And this is a CAT scan done here at UCSD. They have a very large skeletal collection of chimpanzee bones. And the point that I want to stress is that our ability to walk upright, bipedalism, exacts a price. It reshapes the hips of women in particular. And on the upper left, what you see is a baby coming out of the birth canal of different species, different apes, orang, chimp, gorilla, and human. The human head can barely fit out of the pelvic opening. It is the reason we have prolonged painful labor. It is the reason that we have so much trauma with pregnant women giving birth. A chimp, a gorilla, an orang, they squat, they give birth. Boom. In seconds. It just happens. Our brain also has to be smaller. Our head has to be smaller at birth to fit through the canal. And at birth, a chimp brain is 40% of the adult versus 25% in a human. And at a year old, a chimp is about 80% fully formed, whereas the human is 95% by 10 years. I know that's not an exact comparison, but it gives you a sense of it. And there's a theory that that allows the human to wire the brain over a much longer period of time as it's growing, and the child can have social interactions and figure out how to survive in a community, in a group, properly. Chimpanzees are nowhere near as sophisticated as we are in a group. And there are studies of autistic children done here at UCSD that show that their brain growth patterns are too fast, that the wiring is being completed too quickly. And the same idea as, I'm not calling them chimpanzees, please don't misunderstand me, but it's the same notion that we benefit from the slow wiring process that occurs with the slow brain growth. And again, that's a very subtle difference. So we have distinct social structures. This is a chimpanzee group on the left. I hope you can tell the difference. And this is on the right. Chimps have an alpha male. I'm pretty much the alpha male in this grouping over here, I like to think. But if you were to ask my wife and if you were to see us behave together, it's often hard to tell who the alpha is. And that's my mother, who's another alpha, holding a grandchild. In chimpanzee communities, grandmothers don't help rear children, and fathers often, typically, don't know who their children are, because many, many males will mate with a female in estrus. And an alpha male, I was sitting around with a group of chimps like this one day, and the alpha male came along and just started whacking everyone upside the head. They were just sitting around like this, very peacefully, the babies, the moms, and, you know, big alpha comes along, and his name was Nick, and they called him Nick the Prick. There was no reason for him to do this other than to let everyone know, I'm alpha. Now, you know, I know there are humans that behave like that, but we do try to reprimand them and correct them when they do it. In chimp culture, they're rewarded for that behavior. Our differences in reproduction are profound. The picture on the left shows a chimpanzee brain next to one chimpanzee testicle. So two of their balls are the size of their brains. Why is that? They ejaculate 2.5 billion sperm on average in each ejaculate, where humans have about 66 million. That's an enormous difference. The reason is most likely because every female in estrus is available to any male, and so they're competing with each other. It's called sperm competition. They're competing with each other to get the baby. And so the more sperm you put in, the better chance you have. That's a female in estrus on the right, and you can see her vaginal swelling is enormous. Humans conceal estrus. Males have no notion of when a human female is fertile. What difference does that make? Well, it might explain the fact that we have an extremely high miscarriage rate. Humans miscarry about 50% of all conceptions. In one study, in young women who have no reproductive history of any problem, at a median age of 29, the miscarriage rate was 31% in humans. Now, it's even going to go up with older women. And that's not even detecting conception that doesn't get to implantation, because that's all we can really detect. So it's about half of all conceptions in humans fail. In chimpanzees and bonobos and all the other great apes that go through estrus, there's no evidence of high rates of miscarriage, and they have studied looking for the hormones that come out in urine that tell you when a female's pregnant. This is a table. I don't want you to read all this, but this is just to show you the many, many differences that have been documented in disease between our species. Ajit and Nisi Varki here at UCSD have done this research with Kurt Benershka, another UCSD researcher and pathologist. If you look at the top, it's looking at definite differences, myocardial infarction, heart attack, in other words. It's extremely different very, very rare in NHH is our chimpanzees and other great apes that aren't human. And it's very common in humans, especially in males. But chimpanzees do have a heart problem that we rarely have called myocardial fibrosis. Our malarias, they're not susceptible to the main plasmodium that causes malaria in humans. They don't have sexually transmitted bacterial diseases very often, where they're common in humans. HIV in chimpanzees doesn't seem to do much of anything. You can cause AIDS in a chimp with HIV under extreme circumstances by infecting it with many different types and things like that, but that's only happened a few times experimentally. And there are things called foamy viruses that are very common in chimpanzees and that are rare in humans. The list goes on and on. Influenza is mild in chimpanzees. We all know that influenza can cause huge pandemics in humans and kill us off. Alzheimer's disease, very rare, if at all, in chimpanzees, and it's very common in humans. Cancers, most cancers, extremely rare in chimpanzees, major killer of humans. So there are these profound differences in disease. Now, this is extremely important for a few reasons. One, because of the type of research we do with them, we should understand where we're the same and where we're similar. But another is we can be badly misled. Even though HIV doesn't cause AIDS in chimpanzees, if you put a virus in chimpanzees that's very similar to HIV, but is their AIDS virus called SIV, simian immunodeficiency virus, CPZ for chimpanzee, that causes AIDS in chimpanzees. And many chimpanzees in some areas are infected with this, up to 38% in one study, and they're dying from AIDS. So we were misled for years thinking HIV didn't harm chimps until a recent study just a few years ago showed SIV-CPZ, which they could detect in the feces, they didn't have to bleed the chimps, was killing them. We live far longer than chimpanzees. That's one of the oldest living documented chimpanzees on the left at 66 years of age. Lives in a sanctuary in Africa. And that means that chimp is even receiving veterinary care and is receiving food supplements. So it doesn't have to struggle in the wild. And the oldest documented living woman who died a few years back lived to be 122. The chart here on the right is a little complicated, but I wanted to show it to you because it's a really fascinating chart that shows the comparison of hunter-gatherer communities, people who live in Africa and other parts of the world where they have no real modern medicine or access to shelters that they don't build themselves, and it compares them to wild chimps and to captive chimpanzees. And one of the things that I find most interesting is if you look at wild and captive chimpanzees, this shows how much death is occurring. There's a tremendous amount of death in wild chimpanzees at a young age that doesn't happen in captive chimpanzees. And that's because captive chimpanzees are getting veterinary care. Or if there's an abusive mother or father that's going to kill the chimp, they take it away. But after that, their mortality is the same. So it's as though they are set to live. The body is set to survive for a certain number of years. And in a chimpanzee, that set point is somewhere around 40, 50 years. In a human, it's somewhere around 70 years. And again, it doesn't matter if it's a hunter-gatherer human or a modern human who lives in our type of setting or a hunter-gatherer who was acculturated, they call them acculturated, who started to receive medicine. If you make it past childhood as a human, you live to be about 70 anywhere in the world. And if you have our medical care, you live much longer, and even up to 122. So why are we so different? Well, one of the main distinctions between us and the other great apes is that on the right you see chimp and gorilla and orangutan chromosomes that fuse together in the chimpanzee, or an ancestor of chimpanzees that we shared, to form one of our chromosomes. So what used to be numbered 12 and 13 in chimpanzees blended together to form our chromosome number 2. We have 46 chromosomes, 23 copied. We have two of each, so we have 20, one from mom, one from dad. So we have 46. They have 48. That's a major distinction between us. And it creates a reproductive barrier as well. In 2005, the chimpanzee genome was finished, and could, or first draft of it was, and could be compared to humans. It confirmed the long-held argument and evidence that our genes are about 1% different. But our genes only make up a very small part of our genome, maybe a few percent. Our genome is filled with DNA that doesn't code for proteins. It's filled with what's called non-coding DNA. But what we've learned over the past few decades is that that non-coding DNA holds the light switch in his hands for the genes to tell them when to turn off and on. It controls the genes. They're extremely important regions of our genome, even though they aren't genes. When you do a comparison of non-coding regions and of repetitive regions in our genome, chunks of our genomes just splice out and copy themselves, when you compare those differences, there's probably about a 5% difference. And people often think about, oh, I have a gene for this or a gene for that. We have actually a great deal of variation in the number of genes we have. For some things, we'll have 14 copies of the same genes. And there was a finding that there's a gene that helps us digest starch, an amylase gene. Humans have a dozen copies of it because we cook food and eat starches. Chimps have two copies, one from mom, one from dad, or even one copy. So there's a great deal of variation that wasn't appreciated until extremely recently. Another thing we learned from the chimpanzee genome is that we probably evolved, or we may well have evolved, this is an argument, in a much different way than what people imagined. On the left, that's Planet of the Apes on the right. I couldn't resist. If you go to the top of that diagram, that's the common ancestor to humans and chimpanzees, our great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great, whatever you want to call it, grandmother, grandfather. And there was a separation of the two species. Maybe, as Kurt Banerjka argues here at UCSD, it was that chromosomal fusion that led to the separation. Because a 46 can mate with a 48, but they're going to have a lot of loss. And they're going to also have reproductive problems. It's like a horse and a donkey can breed a mule, but the males are largely sterile. But some of them can reproduce. And what this research showed, looking at our genome, is that we may well have split off from chimpanzees and then mated with them again. That's why the lines come back together. And there may well have been a humanzee of sorts that knuckle-dragged or walked the earth, and that split off again into two separate lineages. Now, this is argued. It's not hard and fast factual information, but it was published in Nature, a very prestigious journal that some would argue is as good as Science, where I work. They're both very good. I like to tease them. But it's a very provocative idea that our whole notion of how we evolved is changing with our understanding of the chimpanzee genome. The chimpanzee population is dwindling rapidly. It's gone from a million or a few million 100 years ago to maybe a few hundred thousand now. It's because of habitat destruction by humans. We log their rainforests where they live. We ruin their rivers. We also have bushmeat trade, where some people in remote parts of Africa do eat great apes and sell great ape meat. And there are pets as chimpanzees. There for a time was a research community that took chimpanzees out of Africa, but that stopped with international convention some time ago in the 70s. And there are human diseases that we transfer to chimpanzees, and the closer they live in proximity to us, the more we see chimpanzees getting our diseases, and we're harming them. And also there are farmers who simply kill them because they're poaching. And again, the closer we come to them, the more we ruin their habitat, the more they're going to depend on things like farmed food to survive. So the ultimate difference between us and them is that their fate is in our hands. Our fate is not in the hands of chimpanzees, I assure you, regardless of what the Planet of the Apes movies tell you. They aren't going to determine what happens to humans, but we will determine what happens to chimpanzees. And if we don't correct our behavior rapidly, there will not be chimpanzees, certainly for my grandchildren. And they're disappearing that quickly. So I just want to end on that note, and I thank all of you for listening to this, and And I thank all of you for having me today, too. Thank you very much.
You mentioned that the AIDS virus does exist among the great apes.
Yeah.
And is it sexually transmitted?
It appears to be, yeah.
Does that suggest a sociological behavior or just function of the mating process?
It's probably both sexually transmitted and transmitted from mother to child, as it is in humans. But this is a really new area, and it's unclear still how transmission occurs.
And is it fatal?
The group of chimpanzees that Jane Goodall habituated has had quite a bit of fatality, and there's a study that was published a few years ago that showed a much higher mortality rate in the chimpanzees that had the virus, and also showed that they could that they had immune destruction similar to what's seen in humans that's caused by the virus. Now, you can't bleed wild chimpanzees. You can't get blood samples from them. You're not allowed to dart them, for example, and bleed them. Some have come in for veterinary care, and so they do bleed them then. But there's very, very little information, and what they do is they harvest organs when they die and things like that.
First, with all due respect to start with, your research about one of my favorite animal, the chimps, is very much appreciated, done wonderful work, and fascinating. But I seem to think there's a little bit of too much anthropomorphizing in making the comparisons with humans. I think the study of the chimps and the apes are fascinating in themselves, but why we expect them, or why the study of comparisons when we're not quite two different species, but we are different.
I couldn't agree with you more. And I think and I go into this in my book in great detail, I think this came about for really noble reasons. I think one was the push to make the public accept evolution and Darwin. And if you go back to the Scopes trial in 1926 in the United States, it was a pivotal trial for the theory of evolution. And chimpanzees were brought to the trial. And when Darwin first, in Descent of Man, argued that we had a common ancestor with apes, he in fact didn't say it was chimpanzees. He said it was, you know, great apes. He didn't know if it was chimps or gorillas. There were editorial cartoons of Darwin as half chimp, half man. It was a cornerstone to the original Darwinian argument that we descended from a common ancestor. I think that's silly at this point in time. We have an abundance of evidence that evolution is real, and you don't need chimpanzees to make the argument. The other thing that happened was Jane Goodall in conservation, and she anthropomorphized a great deal, I think, and in order to save chimpanzees, and wanted us to see chimpanzees as much closer to humans than many people thought. They were once called the invention of the devil. People had this hatred for them, even. And she made us love and care about chimpanzees because they were so similar to us. And I think that was a very noble goal, but I think it was distorting as well, and I think it, too, is ridiculous in 2011. What, we shouldn't care for elephants because they look different from us? Well, of course we should care for all species, and it doesn't make any difference whether they look like us or behave like us. So I think the whole concept of protecting chimpanzees because they are similar to us is archaic. We should protect chimpanzees because we should protect all species. And so I agree with you wholeheartedly.
I had two questions for you, both relating again to the differences, so-called differences between the species. One has to do with instinctive behavior. Can you enumerate some of the instinctive differences that the great apes have, instinctive differences that the humans have, and vice versa? And I'd also like to point out that many humans have a spiritual aspect to their behavior and to their thinking. Have you come across anything that resembles that at all in the animal kingdom?
Yeah, let me start with your last question. There are videos, you can see them on the web, of chimpanzees and bonobos grieving a dead chimpanzee or a dead bonobo. And mothers, when their child die, when a mother that has a child die will often carry around the carcass for a few days. Is that spirituality? It sure looks like it. It certainly looks like grief. And I don't know where the dividing line is between grief and spirituality and heartbreak, but when you see the community's behavior around the death of an individual in that community, it's very respectful and sorrowful. So I encourage you to look at those. They're on YouTube. You can look up chimpanzee grief, for example. One of the profound instinctual differences I was explaining to a few people during the break is all grade 8 babies, other than humans, if you put them on their backs, will lift contralateral limbs, a left leg and a right arm, or a left arm and a right leg. The reason they do that is because they instinctually will grasp their mothers, and they hold on to their mothers, typically with chimps, for the first 5 years of their life. A human mother who expected the baby to just hold on would not be a very successful mother. So what difference does that make? Well, Tetsuro Matsuzawa in Japan argues that that grasping behavior and the lack of it in humans may well be the difference in the way we use language, because when a mother puts a baby in a crib, that baby cries to be fed. Those are the rudimentary units of language, he argues. And the mother starts communicating with her separated child on a completely different level because of that. How do you prove that? I don't know. But I think it's a provocative notion. And that's one example of an instinctual difference between us and all other great apes that may well have profound implications for how we speciated in different ways.
As a layman, it seems like there's a lot of similarities between gorillas and chimps. Can you expand on the socialization and similarities between those two groups?
Yeah, one of the main differences, in an evolutionary sense, by the way, we are closer to chimpanzees than chimpanzees are to gorillas. Gorillas probably speciated maybe 12 million years ago from a common ancestor. Gorillas typically have a silverback male who gets all the females. So gorillas have really small testicles and produce tiny amounts of sperm, gorilla males, because they don't need to. If you're the silverback, you got it all. And nobody else has a chance. They're much more sedentary. Gorillas, as researchers or tourists who go on gorilla observation treks and things, and I've talked to them a lot, they'll often say, oh, you know, it was mind-boggling and stunning and also kind of boring. You know, they don't do a lot. They just sort of hang out a lot. Chimpanzees are, you know, they're doing stuff. I mean, they also look like slackers a lot of the day. They siesta a lot. But they're fighting with each other a lot. They're running up and down trees. You know, they're so. Those are a few distinctions. And gorillas, I don't believe, have any hunting for meat at all. I think they're completely vegetarian. And chimpanzees do like a good hunt every once in a while. And it appears that bonobos do too, though that's somewhat controversial.
Have they found homosexuality in chimpanzees?
Yes, but nowhere near to the degree as seen in bonobos. But the criticism is often that most of those studies are based on captivity, and animals in captivity may well behave differently because they're bored or because their opportunities are limited. So yes, they have, but they don't find partnering in any of any communities of chimps or bonobos. So they don't have long-term partners. As I said, go to the San Diego Zoo. It can't be missed. You just spend some time with bonobos. If you can distinguish which sex you're looking at, you'll.
Why don't we have chimpanzees at the San Diego Zoo?
I tried to find the answer out to that question, and no one gave me a good answer. I don't know. My guess is that we did at one point in time. And my guess is what happened is they wanted to distinguish themselves, as zoos often do, with a unique community. There wasn't really an appreciation of the difference between bonobos and chimpanzees until, you know, relatively recently. The zoo's been in existence longer than there was an appreciation that they were different species. And I think what they did was they just sent their chimpanzees off to different zoos once they realized that they had a lot of bonobos and they could breed bonobos. But nobody gave me a good answer, and I did try to get to the bottom of it. So I honestly don't know.
John, with all this compelling and enormous evidence relative to the evolution of species and evolution period, how do you explain the incredible ignorance we have in this country vis-a-vis many other countries around the world on the issue or on the fact of evolution? I mean, we have 45%, according to many surveys, of our public that do not believe in evolution.
Yeah.
We have a large percentage of our Congress that doesn't believe in evolution. We even have presidential candidates who do not believe in evolution. How do you explain that?
I've given that a lot of thought. And I quote a researcher in my book discussing this, and he says, you know, if I give a talk on particle physics and talk about gluons and bosons, nobody at the end is going to challenge me and tell me I'm all wet, I'm all wrong. Religions all have an origin myth. They all have fundamental to the propagation of that religion, passing on that origin myth. So everyone has a stake in it. Everyone thinks they know something because there are three great questions for humans. One is, where do I come from? Another is, why am I here? And the other one is, where am I going? And we all have an investment in those questions. And evolution is saying that I can tell you where you came from. I can give you some idea of why you're here, and I can even give you some idea of where you're going. And that conflicts with every religion. Because there is no religion that says, in the beginning, there was nothing, and then there was a big bang, and then, you know, all this other weird stuff happened, and DNA came out, maybe it came out of an RNA world, we're not really sure, but that's kind of what... No religion says anything like that. So I think that's the genesis of it, is that people have vested interests that they were taught that that's the way it happened, and you're going to challenge that. And I once was at a meeting with called the Frontiers of Science, where they gather the smartest young scientists in the United States who are 40 years of age and under. And we heard a brilliant talk about evolution of life, the beginning, the origin of life. And I ended up having breakfast the next morning with a religious scientist. And I said to her, how do you reconcile your beliefs versus everything we heard yesterday? She said, oh, that's just God testing me. So if that's your philosophy, if that's how you're approaching information, at some point I think you lose your scientific card. And I said that to her, which, you know, she said, well, you're just part of God testing me. But that's my own. And I find that arguing, and creationists have used some of my writings, especially when I wrote an article for Science about the myth of the 1% difference, to say that it's really closer to 5%. And creationist blogs lit up with, you know, even Science Magazine now says that, you know, that we're right. And I went into, you know, a lather and started firing off emails telling these websites to take it down and that people should be fired for this. And I started engaging with them, one being a UCSD graduate who took me on vociferously. And people who argue this, who are the smarter creationists, it's sophistry. They have a little bit of knowledge that what they're saying is they want solid answers for everything. And the world of science is filled with unknowns and embraces ambiguity. And the world of religion is filled with knowns and says, we have the answers for you. And it's very comforting for people, and I think that's why religion does so well. People need that comfort and want it.
Politics.
Politics has a lot of certainty also.
Could you tell us if there's been any research done on apes and major mental illness, like postpartum depression or schizophrenia or classic depression?
Yeah. There has been a good deal of research done with apes in captivity to look at that. And there's a new paper coming out next week or so about apes used in invasive biomedical research to see if that has had a traumatic effect. Captive animals of most every intelligent species suffer from psychological problems because they're in captivity, in a very similar way to humans that are kept in prison. To think that it would be different, unless we're talking about goldfish, it's kind of a stretch to me. Of course they do. Of course the living in captivity has a psychological impact, especially if that captivity is not similar to their natural habitat. There's been a movement with chimpanzees over the past 30 years to create habitat care facilities that more closely mimic the wild. And it would be interesting to study those animals to see if they are psychologically different. By all accounts, they are different. And so there's a cage syndrome that you see with many primates, you know, where they'll bash themselves against the cage. It used to be that chimpanzees, there were no regulations, and they were sometimes kept in very small cages. And the psychological trauma that occurred was obvious to anyone who met the chimpanzees, that they were suffering. But today we have in the United States several islands that are set aside as sanctuaries for chimpanzees, where they're allowed to roam freely and climb trees and do what chimps do and consort with each other as at their will. And I suspect that you'd see far less psychological trauma. Now, in the wild, how do you measure that? And again, it's very difficult. There certainly are individuals that are bad actors, but they're often rewarded by their communities, like Nick the Prick. An alpha male, to me, looks mental. But to a chimp, looks like the boss. And to, you know, chimpanzee communities, if they really could look at us and understand, they might look at some of our leaders and say, whew, there's a mental one there. So,
thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.